Well, when you set out to honor somebody, you certainly honor him. When I think of our wonderful sponsors you've found and your splendid hosts, being hosted by your host and sponsored by the sponsor and guested by you wonderful guests, I've absolutely nothing to complain about, except of course John O'Sullivan's description of my lunching girls with cans of sardines. He didn't get up till 3 in the afternoon at that time. He was parliamentary correspondent, I think, of the Times, and he has no first-hand evidence to about this at all. But apart from this minor fly in the ointment, I'm very, very honored indeed. And there's very little to say which hasn't been said much better by the wonderful speakers who've come before me, by Czestav Milosz and Dr. Wildavsky and Yelena Bonner and, I suppose, John O'Sullivan in a smaller way. I think that, as I say, the main point has been made, that the question that has arisen with us and has arisen and had destroyed the old communist regimes in Eastern Europe and in Russia was basically the question of truth. It was, of course, economic and ecological and physical in that sense, but that also was a matter of lies within the system, a deep lie within the system. But before we go into that, I think I would first of all say that we are now only talking about part of the world. I've been asked to say, has the lesson been learnt? Remember, a large part of the world is still in the grip of Marxism-Leninism. China, as we've been reminded, and Vietnam, and North Korea, that the struggle is not yet over. That is not the area I've been concerned with, but we must never forget it. And this implies a further intellectual and moral effort by the West. Now, in Russia and the other republics of Eastern Europe, as I say, we know the physical, the economic disasters. But one of the reasons was, for half a century, the whole system had one of its main characteristics was falsification on an enormous scale. I mean, history was falsified, production figures were falsified, they're even only now telling us what really happened in the 1930s. Whereas often in the West, even, you got huge figures of industrial production increase, and now they say they didn't happen. The census results were faked. Everything was faked. But even more demoralizing, I think, the whole sphere of thought was controlled and distorted. The inhuman and continuous pressures of the state demanded that all minds should accept what was actually a fantasy. This was incredibly hard for the Russians and for everybody. And worse in Russia and the Soviet republics than in Eastern Europe, because it went on longer. And the struggle against this monster was, I say, a struggle for truth. It was a struggle against terror and oppression, but it was a struggle more against lies. And a handful of voices, some in the West, which is easy, somebody used the word courageous of us, it wasn't at all courageous. The courage was in the Eastern Bloc. The West, our books were published in underground editions. The Western message went over the splendid Radio Free Europe and the other Western radios. But a great deal of what counted was done by the people we think of, like Andrei Sakharov, and a very few thousand dissidents in these countries. They were fighting against an enormous machinery of lies and indoctrination, vast millions of pages every day, millions of hours on the radio, everything in the schoolrooms, everything was telling lies. And these few thousand, and helped to some extent from the West, brought down this frightful Goliath. It bit the dust after this long struggle. And that has been the lesson, I think, that our previous speakers have made that fairly clear, of Eastern Europe. The only people who were able to go on believing these lies, the falsehood behind the whole regime, were very stupid and abject. Something has been written about how very third-rate and nasty and treacherous and mean and lying the second level of the rulership of the apparatus of the privilegia were. This is something you can't put into political science very easily, but this was it was so unpleasant. There are books which say this, and of course the fate of Andrei Sakharov and Yelena Bonner, every detail of their persecution shows this awful level, this impenetrable level. And after last year's incompetent coup d'etat, I was told by one Russian, we were in Russia a month later, we've been ruled by morons for 30 years, this is the first time it's paid off. It was. Now, has the lesson been learnt? Of course, Russia is going through, and the other countries of the East Bloc are going through a terrible period economically. They've got to readjust. They've been ground into the dust by the previous system. They have a hard time ahead. You may well say they don't yet understand the market system, but they know the previous system was no good. They may not know quite what they want, but they know what they don't want. It's quite noticeable that the conspirators in August, their manifesto to the Soviet and Russian peoples didn't mention Marxism or socialism at all. Even they didn't dare suggest they wanted to return to the system. They did, of course, they didn't dare say so. They spoke simply of restoring order and reviving the old frontiers. I think the contempt and hatred felt for the doctrines which ruined the country is very powerful. Incidentally, it's now wholly accepted. I've been at conferences at the foreign ministry that the Cold War was a campaign by Stalin and his successors against the West, against the East European countries, and against the Soviet peoples, the peoples of the Soviet Union, and that the West was not in any way to blame. The blame entirely attaches to them. That is commoner to meet in even official circles in Russia, I'm afraid, than it is in the West. But now, the basic point is that what Russia went through, and what Ethiopia, for example, has gone through, was not the result of some sort of natural change or even bandits or crooks or bad people as such. It was due to an idea, to the Marxist-Leninist idea. The rulers in Ethiopia, these military coups, might well have been thugs and bullies and dictators, but they put through an agricultural program which ruined the country, which even thugs and dictators wouldn't necessarily have to do, simply on the basis of a false idea. I think the first, it's worth thinking what these ideas are like and how they worked out. First of all, I think they thought that they'd found a rigorous and scientific understanding of human society. They thought that was possible and that they'd achieved it. Secondly, they thought that the human society was governed entirely by unappeasable struggle. Who, whom? Lenin's slogan. Everything, every single transaction is a fight, and someone wins and someone doesn't. And then, of course, human beings had to be found who would accept such a dogma without any serious consideration. Well, but let's turn to the West. Think in those terms, those points. What has been learnt, I think, as I say, in a general way, in the Soviet Union, the lesson has been learnt. Is this quite true in the West? I mean, there are people who will say, quite truly, like Francis Fukuyama, that the market idea, the democratic idea, has triumphed. Well, yes, but if you look around the West, I could find the mere existence of the USSR, as I think Elena Bonner pointed out, distorted the way in which many people thought about history and society and economy over here. A lot of the West's elite were deluded, as has been pointed out. The minds open to reality, like Professor Wildowsky's, were not dominant. And one reason was factiousness. Argument about the nature of the Soviet regime became confused, quite illogically, with the internal liberal conservative row in America and elsewhere. And I think I should say that there seem to be an awful lot of Republicans around in my sponsors, I seem to think, there were, my first connection with American politics was with Scoop Jackson, the Democrat. And the question of whether the Soviet Union was frightful or not should not have got mixed up with the conservative liberal row in this sort of way. One of my last books had a cracking blurb by Senator Moynihan that you could be wrong about economics and right about the Soviet Union. I think Czeslaw Milosz would regard himself as liberal rather than not. This is the thing that should not divide us in this way, is one of the view I would take. But it did, to some extent. Albert Camus, the great French writer who has been spoken of already, once pointed out that people who supported the Soviet Union in France were not really, didn't really care about the Soviet Union. He said, it's not that they like the Russians, they hate part of the French. It became a theme of faction in France. Then I think many were seduced by the comfortable word socialism. Isn't it one of Sheridan's plays where one of the women talks about that comfortable word Madagascar, which she recites to herself? The word socialism seduced many people. Nadezhda Mandelstam, the widow of the poet killed by Stalin, says that the word revolution spoilt a whole generation of Russian intellectuals. I think the word socialism spoiled a generation, or helped to spoil a generation of Western intellectuals, not so much in their policies, but in their views of what was going on outside the country. Of course, someone has mentioned, and indeed your institute is particularly concerned with bureaucracy. I don't want to talk about bureaucracy as such, which is a subject which you speak of a great deal, but that, of course, is one of the lessons of the Soviet Union, is that a pullulating bureaucracy is not a very socially pleasant or effective machine. I think that it's easy enough to say that this lesson has not been learned adequately, and you can look around from Detroit to Brussels for examples of what I mean. I think another thing is sheer parochialism played a part in misunderstanding the Soviet Union. No one could believe that a regime could kill millions of inhabitants. I mean, I've spoken to academics who would not believe that Stalin killed 5 or 6 million peasants in the 30s. Why not? Oh, it's economically counterproductive. Well, yes, but I mean, Tamerlane built a pyramid of 70,000 skulls outside Isfahan. Why did he do that? It obviously affected the workforce. They don't know any history. They don't have any idea of the bad motives. That couldn't be done in the University of North Northwest Oklahoma, so it can't be done in Isfahan or the Ukraine. It's Then I think there's another point which is still with us, unfortunately, and that is a political science in its abstract mode. Political science has treated the USSR as simply another state, not much different from any other state, be analyzed by the same methods. We're actually told that academic objectivity means one should not be, quote, judgmental, because that's very unobjective, being judgmental. You say, well, he killed millions of people. Well, you should study something objective, like cotton prices. I'm not joking. I'm just barely. I'm slightly joking, but this is perfectly true. You'd think that the collapse of the Soviet regime would involve the similar collapse of such academic attitudes. Some of those who misunderstood the Soviet experience will no doubt rethink their views. But this habit of mind, I think, persists. Because in Russia, they've learnt the lesson because they experienced it. We have to learn it vicariously. And we still find, first of all, with a view to the idea of a scientific theory of politics, there are still schematic models and methodologies speaking of the rationality of the prediction of human behavior, claiming objectivity but shackled by these inappropriate assumptions. In fact, to be fair to Marxism, it's more flexible and had better claims to universality in some of these recent constrictions on the intellect and desiccations of the understanding. Because I think we should remember that neither in the psychology of the individual nor in the events of society has the human experience really yet proved susceptible to any narrow scientific rigor. We can use our reasons and obtain useful and limited knowledge, but once this is pushed too far, we're in the realm of pseudoscience, like in Marxism-Leninism, and I don't think this is healthy. Then again, the Leninist principle, who, whom? Well, you find in much academic work these days on literature, social order, politics, the notion that everything is a struggle for power, for being empowered, for hegemony, about oppression, all competition is a zero-sum game, just like Leninism. The real world, there's competition and cooperation. Not everyone is driven by power. But that is not recognized in some parts of academe these days. And if you think, Alana, I said people accepted a dogma because it sounded good. Now, if you think nowadays, at the age of 18 or 20, a student meets with a glittering general idea. Far from feeling any responsibility to submit it to serious questioning, he henceforward follows it as if he was a duckling imprinted by its mother. Are students actually discouraged from that sort of activity? Do they see all their incidents subsumed into this, whatever theory it happens to be, the struggle? We're told that the answer to our problems lies in education. This is a very old saying. But does education teach our students to avoid these certainties, to avoid these interpretations of all human actions as struggles, to avoid will-o'-wisp doctrines? Does it aim for intellectual responsibility, the avoidance of formulae and factiousness? I don't think so. That's my impression of the universities and schools of the West at the present. And I'd almost say that it's an educated or half-educated stratum whose minds are still infested often with what in computers we would call a virus, which distorts their calculations. Kafka once wrote that the two great causes of human troubles were impatience and laziness. Intellectually, these are just the phenomena which produce these fantasies. Impatience, the insistence on having a simple formula, knowing it all. Laziness, not bothering to work it out because you've got the formula. So I would conclude that we still have much to learn and much to unlearn from what's been happening in the communist countries and what's been understood of that in the West. It's not yet, even in the Sovietological field, everything is not yet penetrated. There are still people who misinterpret the Soviet Union. But even if they did get that more or less right, there are others who sort of turn their backs on it and still nourish the directions of miseducation which were in part responsible for the whole Leninist disaster. Well, I didn't want to end on as low a note as that. I mean, there are others who don't, and there are, I've mentioned Professor Wildersky, there are many people in this room who are teaching the opposite. All I mean is there's still a struggle to be fought on the intellectual field, and it'll be fought to some extent still on the themes of the Russian Revolution and counter-revolution and Eastern European changes and the future changes in China and Asia. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Dr. Conquest. We have been all recognizing your almost unique contribution to the thinking of the civilized world and the truth about the terrors of communism. It is our pleasure now to present to you the Alex de Tocqueville Memorial Award. In deep appreciation for and recognition of your outstanding and courageous scholarship in unmasking the historical record of totalitarianism in the 20th century and your unwavering dedication to the principle of individual liberty as the foundation of free and just societies, the committee and assembled guests at the National Dinner to honor Robert Conquest, 7th of July, 1992 in San Francisco, proudly present to G. Robert A. Conquest this Alexis de Tocqueville Memorial Award.
If I could also ask Dr. Wu, Harry Wu, to come up. Dr. Wu also has a presentation he would like to make.
This is my first book of my research program, which is supported by Hoover Institution, systematically describe the Chinese Laogai system. I just want to say, Stalin is gone, Mao is gone, Gorbachev changed, Deng Xiaoping exists. But remember, the Chinese evil communism still on our political stage. And I have another book for my honorable host. Thank you. And I want to present as a gift to respectful Mrs. Sakhalov. Thank you.
Bob, if you'd stay just a moment, let us see if there are questions from the floor. We know the hour is late, but if you have a question, here's your opportunity. Are there any?
Yes. What do you think now relating to the Second Amendment to the gun control in the United States? How do you see that battle today on that relation to your work?
Second Amendment?
Well, my copy of the Communist Manifesto has in it revolver prize money, Bisley 1937, I think. So I'm a keen, or was a keen revolver shot. I don't know that it has much bearing on the question between West and East, because some Western countries have very strict gun control and some don't, without much affecting the democratic process. I haven't actually shot a gun for ages, but my wife, just before we married, used to go down into the arroyo and shoot rattlesnakes a good deal, and perhaps she could answer that one. Should we, question is, should America give more support, in one sense or another, to such peripheral countries of the former Soviet Union as the Baltic states? Yes, of course, but we should be supporting all the ex-communist countries. The worse off they are, the worse off Russia is, the more possible encouragement there is to Russian expansionism of the old type. One of the reasons for supporting the Baltics, particularly, I've just come back from there, is of course that they are being smaller and with better farming and so on, they are better investments in some ways. But I think that if you're setting them against Russia, I'm not sure that's the good thing. Russia is also an ex-communist state. These are complications, and I don't see that America should be actually playing off the periphery against Russia exactly. These are matters of foreign policy, and it is in our interests to save the whole of that area rather than exploit national differences, I would have said. Of course, it's not only a question of the Soviet Union. This applies in the Balkans as well. In my view, for example, we talk about the troubles in Yugoslavia being like the troubles in 1914. No, they're not, because there are no great powers who want to make war on account of Croatia or Serbia. I think what will happen eventually is that boundaries will have to be dictated by the great powers. This has happened before. This is how the present boundaries arose. They may not be right, but sooner or later these things are going to have to be settled by a consensus of the great powers, I would have thought. I've got a question from here.
If you were Amnesty International, where would you direct your attention now?
If I were Amnesty International, well, I suppose the China, North Korea seems to be the worst offender against human rights at present. But of course, that's always raised the problem that it's the countries which are behave worst, which on the whole are able to keep their offenses secret. I mean, Stalin was far more popular in the West than Brezhnev was, because he was able either to keep his activities secret or else put out an alternative story, whereas Brezhnev wasn't able to keep his actions secret. But Stalin was far worse than Brezhnev. I think one wants to watch out particularly those regimes like Korea, which are very difficult to get the information out of. They're almost certainly bound to be the worst. But my impression is that Amnesty's work has had a great effect in China, where they're at last beginning to admit, and to a certain extent to condemn or pretend that they're going to condemn, some of the offenses by the secret police. And this is a great beginning. This is, in a certain sense, what happened in Russia. They started to admit that things weren't perfect, that they were oppressing some people, and then they said, oh no, it wasn't as bad as all that. But once they start admitting it, you are winning. And I think that you've done extremely well on China, and that the beginnings are perhaps, this is perhaps going to justify the work on China that's been done by you and other people, which is, of course, has nothing to do with my side of things, but I strongly welcome that type of stuff. A written question. Well, this is really the same question. Please comment on your predictions on mainland China and North Korea. I don't really have predictions. I once wrote a general book about world history and world politics with 2 points in the preface. I said, I don't understand China was one of them. And for me to predict anything about China would be very difficult. But it does seem, speaking very amateurishly, that the beginnings are taking place of the evolution and, with luck, the democratic revolution. It does remind me of Russia about 7 years ago. There are obvious great differences. But with North Korea and the other, and Vietnam, there's still so much difficulty in knowing what's going on that it'd be very difficult to predict, even if you're somebody like me who doesn't like predicting. I think prediction in human history is very shaky. What happened in Russia was in detail, depended on all sorts of accidents, the way it happened. If Yeltsin had dropped dead of a heart attack just before the attack by the tanks on the White House, who knows what would have happened exactly. I mean, there are a lot of things depended on odd individuals, how they happened to feel. If Napoleon had been feeling better at Waterloo, he'd have won. Be from Russia. This is on the Finnish question. Gorbachev, the questioner rightly says that Russia should not have invaded Finland. That has now become normal in Moscow to say that this was a gross aggression, the attack on Finland in 1939. And the question is, will Russia consider returning parts of the territory annexed from Finland in 1940 and later at the end of the Second World War? Well, who knows? I've just been in Vyborg, as a matter of fact, in that territory, and it's now highly Russianized. And I think, secondly, the Finns are not making anything of it. There's very little revanchism in Finland. It's one of those questions like, will the Germans demand the Sudetenland? This doesn't seem to be on. The people are accepting the borders, except where there are minorities spreading across, which there aren't now in this case. Of course, in terms of a general judgment and morality and so on, yes, of course the Russians should retrocede it, but I don't think there's going to be practical politics. Is this another one? Yeah. This is the one about, yesterday the Communist Party went on trial in the Soviet Union. It says, this is just and ironic. Is it appropriate? Is it a show trial of democracy? Well, this is a very interesting question. I must say, it's very odd to read a headline in Izvestia saying the Communist Party is not a party, it's a criminal conspiracy. That would be called, in America, that would be called McCarthyism. The thing is, what they're being tried for is breaches of their own law. They are now, in Moscow, there are now representatives, for example, of the Italian Prosecutor General's office, demanding to know the illegal sending of money by the Soviet Communist Party to the Italian Communist Party. And they're getting perfect cooperation from the Russian prosecutor, because it's illegal under Russian law too, and was even under the old law. In Bulgaria, they're trying, I think, 5 or 6 party and police people for sending, I think it was several hundred million dollars, $200 million, something like that, to countries, to communist movements in places like Angola and Ethiopia and elsewhere, on the grounds this was illegal under the then law. This is slightly different from prosecuting it for just as a political movement. However, we'll see what happens.
Thank you very much, Bob. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much. As I started off saying, time is a really scarce resource, and we've used, it's beyond scarcity. Let's thank the Institute, Monsieur Thoreau, and all of his associates. I'd like to acknowledge my assistant, Elaine Zobel, from the Simon Group, and thanks very much, Mr. Thoreau, for all you've done. We conclude.